Welcome to the Awaken to Wholeness Summit. I'm Val Salidker. Today we have an important voice for planetizing the movement. Someone who is bringing consciousness, cosmology, social and ecological justice to the world as an artist and an activist, raising awareness globally. My good friend, Drew Dellinger.
Hey, Val.
Hey, Drew. I want to tell everybody a little bit more about you because you are really an important voice for our world right now. So everyone, Drew is an international speaker. He's a writer, a poet, a teacher who has lectured and taught extensively across the US, UK, Canada, and Australia. He is the author of the award-winning poetry collection, Love Letter to the Milky Way, an incredible deep dive into the essence of who we are. And he has an upcoming book, Martin Luther King, Ecological Thinker, Toward a Cosmology of Connection. Drew has lectured at numerous colleges and universities and has taught at Prescott College, Naropa University, John F. Kennedy University, where he was also associate professor and director of the program in social ecology. Drew has been called a national treasure by one of my dear mentors, Joanna Macy, a deep and courageous poet by Alice Walker, and one of the most creative, courageous, and prophetic voices of our generation by Cornel West. There it is. Drew, it's so good. It's so good to have you here, and I feel like it's just so important to have this conversation, especially right now.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to be here and to support this vision of the summit, and I think it's really important, so honored to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much. And, because the way that you're bringing it to the world, you bring it in so many ways, and one of the amazing ways as an artist, as a poet, you know, bringing us into that feeling sense. I'd love to invite you to sort of open us up today with one of your poems.
Sure. This poem is called Hymn to the Sacred Body of the Universe. Let's meet at the confluence where you flow into me and one breath swirls between our lungs. Let's meet at the confluence where you flow into me and one breath swirls between our lungs for one instant to dwell in the presence of the galaxies, for one instant to live in the truth of the heart. The poet says this entire traveling cosmos is the secret one, slowly growing a body. Two eagles are mating, clasping each other's claws and turning cartwheels in the sky. Grasses are blooming, grandfathers dying, consciousness blinking on and off. All of this is happening at once. All of this vibrating into existence out of nothingness. Every particle foaming into existence, transcribing the ineffable. Every particle foaming into existence, transcribing the ineffable. Arising and passing away, arising and passing away 23 trillion times per second. When Buddha saw that, he smiled. 16 million tons of rain are falling every second on the planet, an ocean perpetually falling, and every drop is your body. Every motion, every river, every thought is your body. Time is your body. And the infinite, curled inside like invisible rainbows folded into light. Every word of every tongue is love telling a story to her own ears. Let our lives be incense burning like a hymn to the sacred body of the universe. My religion is rain. My religion is stone. My religion reveals itself to me in sweaty epiphanies. Every leaf, every river, every animal, your body. Every creature trapped in the gears of corporate nightmares. Every species made extinct was once your body. 10 million people are dreaming that they're flying. Junipers and violets are blossoming, stars exploding and being born. God is having deja vu. I am one elaborate crush. We cry petals as the void is singing. We cry petals as the void is singing. You are the dark that holds the stars in intimate distance, that spun the whirling, whirling world into existence. Let's meet at the confluence where you flow into me and one breath swirls between our lungs.
Yeah, that is it. That's everything. It's everything, Drew. It's all right there, isn't it?
Well, that was part of the inspiration for the poem. You know, I think of Thomas Berry a lot when I think of that poem and the kind of sense of the cosmos and our connection to the cosmos. And part of what was coming to me when I was writing that was that if we could just perceive everything that was happening at any one moment throughout the galaxy, throughout the planet, every intricacy of every cellular interaction, every instant of photosynthesis, every raindrop that's perpetually falling, there's 10,000 thunderstorms, lightning is striking in every, so part of what I was doing is drawing kind of factoids, if you will, from things that I had read, you know, scientific facts, 16 million tons of rain are falling every second on the planet, lightning is perpetually striking at all times, and thinking to myself, that would be like the ultimate mystical experience, the ultimate poetic experience, just to perceive what is actually happening in every heart, in every cell, in every ecosystem, in every on every planet, in every galaxy. If we could just perceive that for one instant, that would be like such a mind blower, obviously. So that was kind of what was in my mind at the time of writing the poem. And I think it's a good intro to our discussion, because I think that's part of what we're challenged with now. How can we hold everything that's happening? Yes. And there are beautiful things happening. There are celebratory, exultations happening. And there is immense oppression and brutality and violence. And how can we hold all of that and be rooted in a place of compassion and empathy and solidarity and connection? I think the challenge for those of us who live insulated by privilege is a phrase that I use sometimes. For those, so I have male privilege, I have white privilege, I have privilege from living in the United States, I have, relative class economic privilege, I have heterosexual privilege, I have all of these privileges, and most of us are privileged and or targeted in some ways and not others. But how can those of us who are insulated by privilege respond to everything that's happening from a place of love and compassion? Sometimes there's kind of a new agey idea that's like, I want to be rooted in compassion. But there's a way in which if we're insulated by privilege, we're not even aware of everything that's happening.
Absolutely.
So the challenge is not, can I be rooted in compassion while staying in denial?
No, of course not.
About some of the things.
Transcending it. I'm just thinking about this new agey idea of, there's a lot of people around the communities I hang out with too, that there's this kind of idea of transcending it, as if we shouldn't go into the pain or the grief or the fear or
right. The
presence to what's happening, and how dangerous that is. It's just another form of escapism, really.
Exactly. So the challenge is not, obviously, can we be rooted in compassion while staying in denial about racism, oppression, war, and brutality? The challenge is, can we be rooted in compassion while coming into as full an awareness as we can of the brutality, the oppression, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia, etc.? That's the deepest challenge. Not a superficial form of compassion and equanimity that's a form of denial, but a deep rootedness in love and compassion and connection and solidarity while cracking out of denial and into awareness and engagement.
Absolutely. And this your hymn to the sacred body of the universe is really such an amazing invitation into that grounded space of the perception of what we are on a deeper level and recognizing how we fall in love, right? Every word on every tongue is love. And it really has to come, in my opinion, it begins with falling in love with life. You know, recognizing what we are on that deeper level and falling in love with this mystery. You know, because we really act from a space of love. Like when I first started as an activist, it was like fear and anger and confusion. And, you know, it was 20 years ago. And I'm like, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. And how this is going on in the world. And it was like, I didn't know what end was up anymore because everything I thought I knew cracked apart. But when I really started spending time, you know, in wild spaces, you know, and when I really started finding myself on a deeper level, connected to what's happening in the world, to the fact that I am this earth, that I am this great mystery, that I am the body, right, of the secret one, right, slowly growing the body, like that's who we are, what we are. And when I finally got that in my life, everything shifted. It was no longer like I had to do something, like a duty. It was more like I can't possibly not act on behalf of my larger body, which includes everything that's here and everyone that feels oppressed and every starving child and every tree fallen in the name of Starbucks. Like all the stuff that's happening in our world comes from that grounded space of love and recognition of who and what we are, which you capture so eloquently. Yeah, I think that's the beginning of it all. And from that space, we get to really dive in, you know? So what was this moment of connection for you in your life? Like, when did you have that, like, there's something, there's a bigger story here, you know, and you felt called onto this journey? When did that happen for you?
Well, I always had a kind of a dissatisfaction or with the culture as it was and with what I had kind of been born into in the 70s in North Carolina and growing up in the 70s and 80s in North Carolina. And so I had... And I was, you know, had a kind of a rebellious spirit or like the heart of a seeker. You know, it's like I was always kind of looking for other things. So I would, even while I was refusing to do my homework in high school and failing half my classes in high school, I would be at the public library reading, you know, the works of Carlos Castaneda or reading the Seth material by Jane Roberts, you know. And it was around this time that I saw an interview with Bill Moyers interviewing Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth. You know, I saw it on the TV in 1989, you know, on PBS. And that kind of cracked me open to be like, oh, wow, like this is the kind of stuff I want to learn more about. I mean, I already had these interests in like, what is religion? What is philosophy? I want to learn about these things. But to see Joseph Campbell, a comparative mythologist, just kind of unfolding this deep wisdom of the world's sacred traditions, I was like, that's the kind of thing I want to study. I'd want to go to college now, though I wasn't sure because I just hated kind of compulsory education. And I was like, after high school, I was like, I'm tired of people who are totally uninspired, you know, trying to tell me what I have to do all day. But when I saw Joseph Campbell, I was like, I definitely want to go to college. I want to study religion, philosophy, history, psychology, you know, these big picture types of things. And that kind of led to encountering the work of Brian Swim and Matthew Fox and Thomas Berry. And when I read Thomas Berry's book, The Dream of the Earth, during my first year in college at Prescott College in Arizona, and he was talking about the comprehensive context of the story of the universe. You know, we need to, we in Western culture have, you know, have fractured our original relationship to the universe. And we have created an anthropocentric or human-centered culture that separates humanity from the earth, humans from nature. And, you know, and because of the anthropocentric values or the human-centered values, we give all the rights and all the value to the human and no rights and no value to the more than human, to the earth, to the natural world. And he was talking about the stars and the galaxies, that this is one single unfolding process. You know, I'd sat through, you know, physics or science, you know, in eighth and ninth and 10th grade. And I had never seen the story of the universe presented in such a magnificent way that actually made me interested in science for the first time. I was like, what? We are, so when you just kind of reflect on that.
We are the universe reflecting upon itself.
Exactly. I mean, stars, the Milky Way galaxy, given a few billion years, explodes into ecosystems and poetry and Jimi Hendrix and Jane Austen and Nina Simone and Drake and, you know, all of these amazing expressions of music, poetry, art, love, and all of the biological diversity of this miracle planet, the garden planet of the known universe, as Thomas Berry used to call it. So this is the garden planet of the known universe, and we are that. I mean, I remember, just to give you one, I mean, it's very basic now, but it wasn't basic to me as a 20-year-old in 1990 when I went to and met Thomas Berry for the first time at the Earth and Spirit Conference in Seattle, Washington, and Joanna Macy was one of the keynote speakers the first evening, along with Brian Swim and Thomas Berry, and Joanna Macy, there was a big slide image of the Earth from space, you know, the famous blue marble 1972 photograph. And it was behind Joanna Macy as she was speaking. And she kind of turned back and pointed to the Earth. And she said, "That's you. That's what you look like from space." And I just remember going like, "Oh, my God, of course." I mean, it's so basic in a certain sense, and yet it's a spiritual revolution and an intellectual and a philosophical revolution, particularly for a Western culture that has separated itself from the Earth and the cosmos and has convinced itself that there's no wisdom, intelligence, guidance, animation, you know, in the natural world. The only wisdom, intelligence is in the human brain structure. And so, you know, to recognize that
creating in all of our institutions, our educational system, our politics, everywhere, everything is like this dominant paradigm of separation.
I mean, yes,
everywhere.
Absolutely. I can't move a little closer to the mic.
I said, except for what's emerging now, we are seeing this great movement happening right now, like this sort of equal and opposite reaction, you know, this awakening into who we are.
Yeah.
You, Brian Stone, right? What Thomas Berry has left for us, Joanna Macy, Bill Plotkin, like on and on.
Absolutely. And of course, they're building on indigenous tradition and traditional wisdom and the goddess traditions and the best of the religious traditions, particularly the Asian traditions that have a much more organic and cosmological sense, but even can be found in the Western traditions as well. This deep sense of interconnection, interdependence, participation, and mutuality. So when you hear Joanna Macy point at the Earth and say, "That's what you look like from space," or you hear Thomas Berry say, "The universe is a single unfolding process," and you realize that this is a seamless continuum from the flaring forth to the galaxies, to the planets and stars, the oceans, the atmosphere, the first cells of life, the amphibians, the sharks, the crocodiles, the birds, the dinosaurs, the birds, the primates, human beings. It's all one seamless process. It's one energy unfolding and expressing itself in a myriad of forms. You know, that's a perspective changer.
Yeah, big time paradigm hack, you know? It really does. It opens us up to recognizing that. And also this, you know, the idea of this evolution of consciousness is really like the complexity of the bodies, right, of the universe coming into the consciousness that's always been there, right?
Yeah.
Always been this, there's this consciousness that's always there in the universe, and we're just awakening into it more and more, you know, as the universe grow in our complexity and our curiosity of ourselves. It's so beautifully poetic and powerful to understand that and to allow it to break you open in the ways that it has. No, I feel you. So feel you. Even on the Joseph Campbell thing, like that for me was one of those first awakenings as well, getting into comparative mythology and studying religion and the classic literature and like just the great deep stories. And that's why I also love what you bring so much, because you do bring within the poetry, you bring the story. Feeling sense of it, you know, which is more than just spewing a whole bunch of facts and saying, "Wake up." It's like, here's an invitation. What does it feel like to you?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's part of the power of art, and that's part of the power of having our activism rooted in a sense of the sacred and a sense of the spirit, because I do think we're ultimately motivated by love and compassion and connection. You know, we're also motivated by fear and anxiety and survival, you know, and things like this. But I think the things that are most inspiring, the things that mass movements are built on, the things that magnetically draw people to want to be involved
and sustain the involvement. Because we can get involved when we're like, and then we burn out or something else happens, whatever it is. But when we're driven by our love, when we're driven by our passion for justice, forget it, we're unstoppable.
Yeah.
And so Thomas Berry, you know, he really brought to us this idea that we're caught between two stories. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that, you know, what we're moving into.
That's right. So in 1978, Thomas Berry wrote an essay called The New Story. And the opening sentences, and he actually published it in 1978. It was also gathered into his book, The Dream of the Earth, in 1988. But I think it's very important to remember that it was, you know, 37 years ago or whatever, that Thomas Berry laid out this idea of the new story in this essay, The New Story. And it starts out, he says, it's all a question of story. We're in trouble just now because we do not have a good story. We're in between stories. The old story, the account of how the world came to be and how we fit into it, is no longer effective, yet we have not learned the new story. And so when Berry was talking about the new story, he was very much talking about this vision of the cosmos that, again, is very much a traditional indigenous sacred vision, but had been lost in Western culture, that had said, the earth and nature are dead, inert, material, inanimate matter. We walk around on top of the earth. We're separate from the earth. The earth is good to the extent that it can provide us resources that we can exploit, et cetera, et cetera. And Berry was saying, we need to come back to a connection in Western culture with the planet, with the cosmos. We need to recognize that the earth is primary and that humanity is secondary. Yeah. And that doesn't mean we're not going to take care of humanity. That means the only way we can take care of humanity is by taking care of the self-sustaining, life-giving, nourishing systems of the planet Earth. If we take care of that community, the Earth community, then we will have the context in which we can take care of humanity. And so Berry's was very much an ecological, cosmological vision of a new story that was emerging in Western culture. And he was seeing the evidence and the emergence of it all around, and very much drawing on traditional indigenous wisdom, but also with the new sense of science and empirical observation, that we have photographs of galaxies now. We didn't have photographs of galaxies in the past. We can see Andromeda. We can see, you know, all of these things.
One of the things about this particular moment in time is that we have this ancient wisdom that's always been here, been with us, is still inside of us, even in us, our DNA, even here in the Western world, like it's within us. There is this wisdom within us. And then there is this science, right? That's the sense of sort of this non-duality of coming together and recognizing that it's all really one thing underneath it all. Yeah, so like we have this wisdom of exploring ourselves through science and what science is teaching us, and that beautiful blue jewel floating in space, you know, and the galaxies beyond, you know, the light from the beginning. Like we can see all these things, and it's giving us such a deeper sense of ourselves married to this ancient wisdom of knowing that we are deeply part of everything that is woven into that web of light. This is a special moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So part of so what Berry was talking about was very much this new sense of the earth and the cosmos, this reconnection that's emerging in our time, and cracking out of the anthropocentrism and the kind of materialistic, mechanistic thinking of since the scientific revolution, you know, type of thing. But I also think there are multiple levels to the new story that's emerging. And so part of what my work, drawing on the legacy and having spent 20 years with Thomas Berry, is to what are the ways in which some of Berry's ideas and analysis can actually fit into a social justice analysis as well. So I think we're also living in a time where new stories are emerging in terms of who has a voice, who has a seat at the table. So we can look at the 60s, for instance, the 50s and 60s as an immense period of democratization, where African Americans stood up and revolutionized the United States, broke down an apartheid system, and actually created for the first time something resembling a true democracy. I mean, you can quite clearly say that we don't have anything resembling a democracy until the 1965 passage of the Voting Rights Act. So as Taylor Branch and others have pointed out, we should see Dr. King and Rosa Parks and Claudette Colvin and Diane Nash and Dorothy Height and Joanne Robinson and Ella Baker as the founding fathers and mothers of American democracy. I mean, it was that civil rights movement through the 50s and 60s that got us closest to something resembling democracy with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So we've seen, and then we have the feminist, the second wave of the feminist movement. And we have the indigenous movement, the American Indian movement, now the indigenous, global indigenous movement. We have, the LGBTQ liberation movements. You know, we have a powerful trans movements that are emerging. So I think we're just riding in these past few decades a wave of democratization, a wave of moving toward a real, actual political and spiritual democracy in this country and on this planet. And, there's a long way to go. We've got immense patriarchy and systemic racism and white supremacy and classism and capitalist corporatist exploitation and violence and war and abuse and brutality. And yet we can just look at the progress of the last few decades, even with the kind of backsliding that we may be seeing in certain areas and in the political situation right now. But there's no question that there's been an immense evolution of and democratization of our societies in just a few decades. So there's lots of reasons for hope at the same time that there are reasons for despair as well.
Yeah, it's really important for us to talk about that, that there are these movements happening right now. Like I'm looking at what's happening and what's been happening with Standing Rock. Talk about this indigenous movement and how it is really like for the first time all of these different beautiful indigenous tribes have come together with one vision, and that is to protect the earth, and how all these people now are standing up and saying yes to that, people going out there, people supporting from all over the world, that this is like this moment for us to say here, what's most important, what is really most important in this moment. At the same time that we have this crazy political situation that we're in, very extreme on both ends. It's almost like Stephen King's The Stand. Like I mentioned this the other day, even might've mentioned it on another interview, but it feels like in some ways, like I know that's a little bit dramatic, but it kind of feels like there's this, it's like you have to choose which worldview, which paradigm, which cosmology. It's time to choose. We have to stand behind something and move forward. And there's really only one way to move forward. Because we're seeing our systems collapsing all around us, and it's just going to continue doing it as we see part of our society fighting to hold on to this old way of being that doesn't serve, that doesn't work, that isn't sustainable. It's all collapsing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the movement at Standing Rock is so important and so vital and is really the threshold of the path into the future, because it's connecting these ecological and social issues. So we have the issue of water, we have the issue of oil and extraction and pipelines, but we also have the issues of colonialism and the issues of white supremacy and systemic racism and the abuse of indigenous communities. So we have all of these ecological and social issues that are converging at Standing Rock. And part of what's so significant about Standing Rock is also the cosmological. The worldview. What is the world in Standing Rock? Each side of that river, each side of those front lines, you see two different worldviews coming into conflict with each other. You have the indigenous worldview based in biological reality that water is life, and then you have the capitalist corporatist worldview in which money is power, nature is resources to be exploited. This industrialization is the all, it's built on a myth. It's built on a myth in the negative sense of a false story. It's built on a false narrative that we have, an infinite planet that can be exploited indefinitely. And that's just not where we're at. We're on a finite planet with limited resources, with limited fresh water, with aquifers that renew at a certain rate and not faster. And with the planet, you know, Thomas Berry was very into the word irreversible. We have ecosystems on this planet that can be irreversibly damaged. I mean, you know, maybe they'll regenerate in 35 million years. But we don't even know, even that is speculation. We don't know for sure how much the Earth can regenerate if it becomes completely irradiated or toxified or stripped of life and diversity. So, you know, so the entire industrial corporatist capitalist vision is based on a false narrative. It reminds me of something Edward Goldsmith once said, who was the editor of The Ecologist magazine. And I remember him speaking, and he said, what we're trying to do is difficult, but what they're trying to do is impossible. And what he of course meant the corporatist capitalist mentality that thinks you can have limitless growth on the finite planet. That's just not going to work. But it's right there in Standing Rock. You got one worldview that money equals power. You've got another worldview that water equals life. And so along with Standing Rock, you know, I would also mention the Movement for Black Lives.
Absolutely.
Movement for Black Lives, I think, is the most significant action for racial justice that we've seen in 50 years in this country. And it's in the same way that one of the reasons Standing Rock is so important is because it's indigenous led and youth led. You know, it was a 13-year-old young woman, I believe, who initially inspired the South Dakota Standing Rock Sioux tribe to say, you know, we can actually stop this pipeline. In a similar way, part of the importance and the significance of the Movement for Black Lives is that it's youth-led, Black-led, women-led, queer-led. So these most affected communities have the wisdom, the expertise, the courage, the vision, and the commitment to lead us all into a beneficent and harmonious future of ecological and social justice. So there's no question that the roads to the future, there's a place for all of us, but they're going to be Black-led, youth-led, led by the South, led by women, led by groups that have been traditionally targeted and oppressed. And so those of us with white privilege or male privilege are going to have to recognize that part of our leadership is standing in solidarity and supporting the leadership of women, of youth, of communities of color, of indigenous communities, et cetera. And that's a large part of what leadership looks like in this moment.
Yeah, those are all so just really important points. And it is so symbolic what's happening right now and how it just holds everything that we're talking about in this movement right now. It's like one of the biggest movements of our world. Really important time, Drew.
Yeah, so that's why I say we need to build movements that connect ecology and social justice and cosmology or worldview. I mean, that's what cosmology is, the big cultural story. Cosmology is the basic sense of the universe, how it came to be and how we fit into it and what our role is in it. So cosmology is the study of the cosmos, but it's also the story of the cosmos. What is the story that a culture tells about how the world came to be, how we fit into it? And so, you know, drawing on my studies with Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, you know, they see cosmology as so foundational. Religion grows out of cosmology, economics, politics, our sense of ethics, all of this emerges from our foundational, fundamental story, our primary narrative of how the world came to be and how we fit into it. And so that's a dimension that you don't hear as much in activist circles, though there's starting to be more and more of an appreciation of the power of story, the role of narrative, the importance of cultural stories and worldviews. So this is why I've been saying we need to build movements, continue to build these movements that connect ecology, social justice, and cosmology or worldview. And we need to build those movements using the power of dream, the power of story, the power of art, and the power of action. So, you know, it's not just the power of action. It's not just one more sit-in, one more blockade, one more civil disobedience. It's drawing from a deep place of dream. What is the dream? What is the vision? What are the guiding images, symbols, motivations, you know, from the depths of our being and from the depths of Gaian wisdom, from the depths of the earth, from the depths of the cosmos, from the depths of our own hearts, which are as infinite as the galaxies. Mm-hmm. And so we need the power of dream. This is why Thomas Berry called his book The Dream of the Earth. Right. The earth is dreaming itself into being, and we are either going to continue shredding that dream that the earth has been evolving, or we as Western modern industrialized culture are going to get back in tune and in harmony and in balance and in reciprocity with the dream process that is the earth itself unfolding, with the dream that the galaxies are dreaming into existence, with all of these species that, you know, we're part of, that are part of the Milky Way galaxy. So dream is very important. This is where our vision comes from. This is where our inspiration comes from. Paul McCartney woke up with the melody for Yesterday in his head. Keith Richards woke up with the riff for Satisfaction in his head. Gandhi woke up with the idea that you could have a nationwide fasting strike, basically what he called a hartal. The idea for the first national hartal of the Indian independence movement came to Gandhiji as he was awakening from the dream state. So the dream state is incredibly important, both artistically and in terms of our social imagination and our political vision. And so, you know, that's a little bit on the power of dream. I could go through story and art. I think you have a sense. We've talked about the power of story. We've talked about the importance of narrative. We've had these stories that separate us from the earth, that tell us that the earth is a limitless resource that we can exploit. That's a dysfunctional story. That's a dysfunctional ecological / spiritual story. But we also have dysfunctional stories of racism, dysfunctional stories of sexism and patriarchy and homophobia and transphobia. So we've got dysfunctional stories operating on the ecological level, but also on the social and political levels. And so we need to understand and utilize the power of story as we build a harmonious and peaceful future. And then we have the power of art. We talked a little bit about it when we were talking about poetry, but it's that level of heart connection that motivates people. The arts are immensely important. They are not an add-on. They are not an addendum. They are not like, oh, at the last minute of our political organizing, we figure out that we need a poet to come do an invocation or so. You know, it's like, no, we have to be thinking artistically. We need to be operating on the levels of imagination, metaphor, myth, symbol, and we need to be proficient in how we communicate. So discernment and right speech and artistry and imagination and the poetic capacity to feel our connection to other beings, and the poetic capacity to eloquently and powerfully articulate our connection and our vision and our hearts and our compassion and our solidarity. I mean, arts are not, even in progressive circles, even on the political left, even in, you know, spiritual, new age, whatever, consciousness circles, even artists, even we don't quite get the importance of the arts. Even in our progressive and spiritual circles, we subtly devalue the role of the arts. We see them as optional. We see them as something to add on.
They're being phased out in school.
Yeah, exactly. Always the first to be slashed when there's budget cuts in schools. But the power of arts are fundamental to vision and to communicating a vision. And then there's the power of action. You know, we need action. We need activism. We need civil disobedience. We need resistance. We need to stand up to fascism and neo-fascism. And so I think this is part of why someone like Martin Luther King is so important. Also, you know, we can look at the women of the civil rights movement, Claudette Colvin, Dorothy Height, Daisy Bates, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. They all have the same kind of Kingian combination of heart and steadfast resistance. Love and solidarity, but an absolute steadfast commitment to say no and to interrupt injustice. And this is where Gandhi, again, is pivotal in this. How can we hold the love and the compassion and the reconciliation with the courage to stand up and say no and to interrupt injustice? Gandhi talked about interfering or interrupting with injustice, interrupting evil, interfering with injustice. Gandhi said, I learned to say no from the West. And so we have this kind of prophetic element. You know, there's a sense in which in some progressive or spiritual or new agey circles that the only mode of spirituality is non-attachment and equanimity. And those are absolutely critical and crucial and important. And I do often point out that there are other modes of spiritual engagement. And in the West, we have the prophetic tradition. You know, we have those prophets who have been willing, and not just the Hebrew prophets of old who are the archetypal examples of the prophetic tradition, but we have men and women throughout history, Sojourner Truth, Ida B. Wells, all of these folks, the great Harriet Tubman, of course, people who said, I'm going to say no, I'm going to courageously interrupt, I'm going to use powerful speech that may even actually offend people. I'm going to, put myself in conflict with the political and religious authorities if necessary. I mean, these are some of the core elements of the prophetic tradition. So, and that's another spiritual approach. How do we say no and stand up at the same time maintaining our equanimity and our non-attachment in a certain way, and our compassion and our love and our reconciliation. And there was one last thought on that, which is, it'll come back to me. But basically, I think that's part of where we're at now, is that we have to hold the spiritual and the activist commitment, and there's nothing, it's not, oh yeah, it's, oh, the thought was almost come back. It'll come back.
It's getting me thinking about what activism looks like. All the classical ways that you're talking about, our civil disobedience and our direct action and it literally getting involved with the stopping actions, getting involved with what's happening now and slowing down or stopping the things that are, injustices in the world. And I think it's important to recognize that there's a lot of ways that we can be activists and be part of this, solution, as artists, as writers, as event producers, as, like this summit, for instance, is...
Yeah.
For me, when I got started, honestly, Drew, I started in animal rights. Like, I was like, what are we doing to other animals? And it blew my mind, and I heard myself saying all the conditioned things that I was taught to say. And then the more I started researching, the more it just didn't feel right anymore. And so for me, it started in this like full on hardcore, direct action, civil disobedience, like things I can't talk about, like getting involved in all kinds of ways. And it formed in so many ways as well, into education, into building new structures, into participating in permaculture, so there's just so many ways that we can take part in this new story as well, and it's for everybody that's listening to just like, when we're thinking about how can we get involved and how can we participate, and that invitation is to really like take a breath and take a look inside yourself at what gives you hold, and how the ways that you need to show up. And maybe that is putting your body on that line and shouting no and getting involved in civil disobedience. Absolutely. Those are very powerful ways and we all need to take part. And maybe there's other ways that are calling to you as a teacher, as a mother, educating ourselves in these ways to pass those legacies on. So there's a lot of ways to participate. There's a question about participation, and it's making me think of Hieroglyphic Stairway. I don't know. Whenever you'd like to bring it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's read that. I would just say what you're saying reminds me of Martin Luther King said, each of us must decide on the form of protest that best suits his or her convictions, but we must all protest.
Yes.
And to protest is to stand for something, to affirm positively that we believe in the beauty of this planet. We believe in the sanctity of each other. we believe in the majesty of our connections to each other. So,
yes, and to piggyback on that, the idea of standing for something rather than standing against something is it's really crucial to recognize that. We know what we don't want, but we want to put all our focus on what we do want and what we're creating. So it is a question of what are you standing for?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, here's a poem called Hieroglyphic Stairway. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great, great grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great, great grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing. As the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? I'm riding home on the Colma train. I've got the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I have teams of scientists feeding me data daily and pleading I immediately turn it into poetry. I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech. I am the desirous earth, equidistant to the underworld and the flesh of the stars. I am everything already lost. The moment the universe turns transparent and all the light shoots through the cosmos, I use words to instigate silence. I'm a hieroglyphic stairway in a buried Mayan city, suddenly exposed by a hurricane. A satellite circling Earth, finding dinosaur bones in the Gobi Desert. I am telescopes that see back in time. I'm the precession of the equinoxes, the magnetism of the spiraling sea. I'm riding home on the Colma train with the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I am myths where violets blossom from blood like dying and rising gods. On the boundary of time, soul encountering soul and tongues of fire. It's 3:23 in the morning and I can't sleep because my great, great grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the earth was unraveling? I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech.
We're listening, we're receiving that, you know, this invitation to become and be the ancestors that we are to those future ones. That's it, you know? We have this information, we're talking about it. Anybody that's listening right now can't pretend we don't know. You know, this is here, it's real. It's all here right now, you know? And what we do with it determines the next year and 10 years and 100 years to come and our children and great-grandchildren's future and the future of Earth, the future of life. We're in the midst of a mass extinction we haven't seen in 65 million years, losing like, what, 50 to 100 species a day? It's crazy. It's unheard of. I mean, you know, for the first time, that actually reached mainstream news.
Right.
There's been articles out about mass extinction.
Yeah.
We haven't seen that until like in the last, I don't know, a couple months that they're talking about. It's like, you can't not talk about it anymore because it's happening and it's very real and one thing affects everything else because everything is interconnected. When we lose the, you know, 10% of sharks we have left, the entire food chain and the ocean crumbles. Mm. Hey, everything affects everything else and we're in this and this is the invitation of our time. You know, how do we participate? In what ways are we showing up? In what ways are we contributing to the poverty and the oppression and the racism and the ecological degradation? You know, we're all participating in some ways, So we need to start asking ourselves, in what ways can I be uncomfortable?
Yeah.
In what ways can I step up and make some changes in my own lifestyle? Because look, if one person does it, 10 people do it, 1,000 people do it, every little thing we do makes a huge difference when there's a lot of us doing a lot of little things.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. Absolutely. And we wouldn't be seeing the mass extinction crisis breaking into the mainstream media if it hadn't been for the decades of work of people like Thomas Berry and Joanna Macy and Robert Bullard and people that have been on the front lines of environmental justice movements and ecological struggle. So, you know, we come from this lineage of ancestors, and I think we feel the pull and the support and in a sense, the obligation that we owe to the ancestors that have come before, who have made possible through their sacrifice, through their love, through their vision, through their joy, through their courage, you know, the world that we have. And so we feel a responsibility to continue that world, to continue the beautiful flowering earth based on the ecological and human, you know, ancestries and lineages that we're part of. And I think part of why this summit is so important, and I think this was the thought that had slipped out of my mind earlier, is that, you know, one of the things that it's an old saying, it's become possibly a cliche by now, but there's that old phrase, silence is complicity. Silence is complicity. You know, we have these social structures, these political structures, these economic structures. We have that the status quo, if you will, the system, the powers that be, the establishment. And if we're to the degree that we're silent, you know, there's a degree that we're complicitous in that. And so sometimes, you know, people go in kind of new agey or progressive or conscious circles, they go like, oh, well, I'm just so concerned about how angry activism is. I understand that. But to me, the big problem on the planet is not there's way too many angry activists. I mean, yeah, I get where that's coming from. I understand that anger is off-putting and ultimately not as effective as some other strategies. But to me, the big problem is that silence is complicity, and that we've got a lot of silence and a lot of complicity. And so if I begin to feel in the next few months or years or decades that the big problem is that there's too many activists being too assertive, you know, then maybe I'll start speaking more about that. But what I talk about is that we need to come together and build movements that connect ecology, social justice, and worldview. And we need to build those movements with dream, story, art, and action. Because to me, the big major problem is the silence, the complicity, the status quo that is oppressing people and communities and destroying the garden planet of the known universe. So I'm less concerned with a few activists here and there that are a tiny bit too angry, and I'm more concerned with the fact that silence equals complicity, and we've got a lot of silence and a lot of complicity as communities and people are suffering and the planet is burning up.
Absolutely. And it's definitely like, there's no way we can continue with business as usual. That's the message we all need to hear right now, you know, in whatever way we can get involved, whatever way we can speak up, you know, this is that call to action now to really find out how we can all take part in making a difference right now in our world. And if you see something happening next to you, call it out. You know, we all need to be each other's keepers right now too. So yeah. This silence includes like when you see injustice happening. And I like to reframe this idea of anger too, because like as Joanna Macy talks about, underneath that is our passion for justice.
Yeah, that's right.
When you see somebody speaking up like that and have this intensity about them, it's passion. It's passion for what's good and right and holy in this world, you know, and what we're being invited to step into right now. And there's no other way. This is the only way forward. You know, it is. This is the time for us to talk about how we participate, to you know, just get into our voices in whatever way that looks like for us. You know, it's important right now. Planetize the movement.
Right? That's right. That's right. Yeah, I was speaking at a spiritual conference last year, and, you know, one that was very rooted in mindfulness, you know, kind of approach. And I said, you know, when you see somebody that's angry, maybe it's a young person, maybe they sound a tad strident to your ears. When you see somebody that's angry, don't make the mistake of assuming that that's not a spiritual person. you know, that could be a prophet in our midst. You know, and I want to support the prophets in our midst, and I want to support the prophet in each of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do. What an invitation. What an invitation right now, this moment. The wind is coming in. Here it comes. Woo! I think I'm getting a confirmation.
Yes.
We're on the right track, you know? And I think our world is really blessed to have voices like yours, you know, speaking out from the heart, speaking out from this passion, from this deeper awareness of self, you know, that we are the universe reflecting upon itself. I know the first time I heard that was like, I was already into it. I already had been working with Joanna Macy and following Brian Swim, who's part of our summit, and I can't wait to dive in and, you know, share that with everybody as well. You know, and the first time I heard that really actually brought me to Genesis Farms. Study the work of Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, you know, with Miriam McGillis. So it was really part of my journey. And I remember the first time I heard that was like, you know, we are the universe reflecting upon ourselves, like that idea. It was this huge, like I knew it and I felt it, but I didn't have the words. And those were the words. Those were the exact words. And I remember I was in university in my graduate class, and I ran to a friend of mine who was also an, you know, ecologist. And I was like, listen to this. And I shared it. And he was like, that's cool. And I'm like, no, that's not cool. That's everything. I was like, somebody like jump up and I should have called you. Drew, do you know this? Of course you know this. It was like one of the most exciting moments ever. Mm. You know, in that moment, like those epiphanies, those moments of epiphanies that we have,
yeah,
where it just deepens your understanding. It takes you to the next level, and then you move yourself to the next level, and then it keeps going. You know, the deeper we dig, the more we're given, and the more we're given, the more we dig, and the more we get, the more we feel, the more we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Ashe.
Well, Drew, I'm so grateful to have you. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. I don't know, is there anything else you want to share right now? Anything else that wants to be said?
Yeah, I'll just, I just want to thank you, Val. I mean, your heart and your compassion and your vision, you know, are really coming through so clearly in this summit and in all of your work. And it's been a real treat to be connected with you. And I look forward to more as the years unfold. And so I just want to thank you. And then I'll just read a short, tiny little poem, because I like to read something new if I can't. And so here's a tiny little shorty that's fairly new. I'm still calling it new. It's called We Make Music. So I'll just leave you with this offering. We exist amidst the scattered shards of shattered stars. We exist amidst the scattered shards of shattered stars, and we make music. We rock on this rock. We flow on this globe. We go from muddy to buddy, from Janis to Alanis, from Charlie Parker to Ali Farka, from Artie Shaw to Mardi Gras, from Madonna to Rihanna, from Raga to Gaga, from Ode to Joy to Soldier Boy. The earth was once lava and now sings opera. Our home is a poem. The planet is a sonnet. We exist amidst the scattered shards of shattered stars, and we make music.
I love it. My whole heart is like, yes. So grateful for you, Drew. And the earth was once lava, and now it sings.
I borrowed that from our friend Brian Swim.
I heard it. It's so perfect. So perfect. And it's such an important reminder. You know, just on every level of what's possible within us, you know. Everything. And I'm glad to be on this journey with you.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right, here we go.
All right, thank you, sister.
Yeah, brother. I mean, this is it. Yep. We're walking into our future, and now we've got thousands more people tuning into this, saying yes and stepping forward with us, because together we are unstoppable. You know, we're moving into the future, and we've got the tools, we've got the information, we've got the poetry, and we've got the love.
Indeed. Well, it's an honor to be connected and in solidarity with all of you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All righty. Bye, friend.